Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
There's a question that's been bugging me for a while now.
How many flies have ever existed?
Crowd Science, the podcast with a thirst for knowledge.
Why do we daydream?
Why is the sea salty?
We'll go and try and speak to some people and find out.
Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. We'll hear how Burundi is handling Mpox, a disease that has claimed hundreds of lives in the neighbouring DRC. So is there a risk of regional spread?
I would say that probably if things remain as they are, Charles, it's only a matter of time, unfortunately, before we see a replica probably of what is happening in DRC here in Burundi.
And why are funerals so expensive in some African countries? We'll hear the answer and how some Kenyans think saving for it is the way to go.
People will spend on coffin. People will have to preserve the body. They will take the body to the morgue. They'll have to get clothing for the body. There's also some other culture that they have to prepare meals.
It's like a ceremony. They'll have to ensure that they have a convoy of vehicles.
It's Friday, the 23rd of August. First, we start with matters pertaining to Russia. It's been a year since the leader of the Russian mercenary group Wagner died. He was first and foremost a Russian, but also a former convict, a chef, a hot dog salesman, and influential leader of a private military group involved in wars in Africa, particularly in the Central African Republic, Libya, Mali, and Sudan. Yevgeny Prigozhin was equally admired and hated in the Russian capital, Moscow. In fact, he was held in high regard by the Russian President Vladimir Putin. That is until Mr. Prigozhin crossed Mr. Putin. He's reported to have died in a plane crash. Here is the BBC's Nur Abida with more about Prigozhin and Wagner.
A year ago, a real-life war drama was unfolding in front of everyone's eyes.
Well, let's start straight away with that dramatic breaking news in a quite extraordinary day in Russia. The leader of the Wagner
group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, a Russian oligarch, leader of a group of mercenary fighters known as the Wagner Group, was staging a rebellion against Russia's president, Vladimir Putin. The Wagner Group has been involved in conflicts across Europe, the Middle East, and Africa since 2014. Now, its leader was staging a public confrontation with the Kremlin, blaming the lack of support for its troops. In its public outbursts, Prigozhin never named Putin. But in the eyes of the rest of the world, this episode marked a rare challenge to Putin's authority. Then just 2 months later, on the 23rd of August 2023,
we start this hour with some breaking news. Authorities in Russia have confirmed the head of the Wagner paramilitary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, has died in a plane crash, which crashed northwest of Moscow on Wednesday. They confirmed.
Since then, Wagner has changed. Russia has proceeded to restructuring its operations around the world. And in Africa, it renamed it as Africa Corps. Then, in February, the BBC obtained documents revealing that Moscow was offering governments in Africa a regime survival package in exchange for access to strategically important natural resources.
The BBC's Nur Abida. So the change from Wagner Group to Africa Corps, was it just a change of the name? Sergei Goryashko, a colleague from the BBC Russian service, has been telling me more.
Wagner as a company, as a private military company, it doesn't exist anymore. So it got absorbed into Russian military structure, both in terms of those fighters who were at the front line in Ukraine and their operations in Africa. And that's where we can talk about the African Corps, which is a kind of a successor of Wagner's operations on the continent. The only country where Wagner is trying to do sort of the same business they used to be doing during Prigozhin's times is Central African Republic. And there, Prigozhin's son Pavel is allegedly active. So he keeps his connections with the Central African Republic and President Touadera. They still provide him services of security, and they still explore resources of the country. And if we're talking about other countries of the continent, especially of Sahel part of the African continent, there we get the African Corps, which is basically just a division of the Russian Ministry of Defense.
So help us just remind our audience what these operations are. Basically, what was the operation of Wagner in Africa, in African countries? Because you've just described sort of how it's changed since Prigozhin died.
Back in the day, when Prigozhin had a good relationship with the Kremlin, he was basically earning money in Africa. He was providing some sort of services, like, first of all, it's security services, like training of the military or security of the current leader. And he provided those to relatively poor African countries. And he basically can do there whatever he wants to do with some sort of support from the Russian government, but without any sort of official legend or official status on the ground. So here comes Central African Republic, as he's one of the biggest grounds of operations, also Mali, Burkina Faso, as well as Sudan, as well as Libya. Furthermore, apart from the military services, Wagner Company was also active in terms of politics, media, and social issues in the countries. So they were providing as not only military support, but political support to the leaders who were often came to power after the military coup. They were providing them political consulting. They were setting up operations like in the media, setting up new medias, radios, websites. Sometimes those were spreading misinformation, disinformation in the country among the audiences. And what they got for that was the possibility to exploit the resources of the country. So Prigozhin's companies were exploiting gold mines in Central African Republic, for instance, and were also interested in diamond business and many, many others. And the Kremlin wanted the West to be ousted from the African continent, from the countries where the Western powers like France, for instance, they used to be active in Mali or in Central African Republic.
I'll pick you on that last point there about, you know, Russia wanting foreign powers like the US and France being, you know, removed basically from all their influence being reduced in countries in the Sahel. And we've seen that happen. But now that you're saying that Africa Corps is, you know, an arm of the Ministry of Defense of Russia, are we then saying that this is a more direct involvement of Russia in Africa, and it's not just going through a private military company that, you know, they can, if things don't go right, they can basically pull off and say, we were not part of the agreement?
Yes, of course. So the idea to use Prigozhin's fighters in Africa was exactly that, to have the possibility to pull out or to say that Russia has not any direct involvement in those countries. It's all about some private entity, just a businessman who decided to do something on the continent, but it's not in the name of the Russian government, which allowed Prigozhin to do many dark things on the ground, like executions, like killings of the locals, and many, many more crimes. So now it is more of an official operation, which Russia desperately needs, not in, only in terms of its of gaining resources, but also in terms of projecting its influence, like anti-colonial sentiment shared by some of the locals in Africa. Although what Russia does there now is actually the same colonialism, but in other words. So what Russia is doing, Russia is backing the leaders which are working in favor of Russia, which allow Russia to harvest the resources from the countries to exploit them as much as they can. And Russia helps those leaders only while they are publicly back in Russia. Like recently, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Central African Republic, their leaders wrote a letter to the United Nations Security Council condemning the Ukraine's aggression. So Russia needs those kinds of gestures to show that it's not at all isolated from the entire world because of its aggression in Ukraine, but is still has many, many supporters all over the planet. And there are some leaders in global south who are willing to support Putin.
And how effective was Wagner and now Africa Corps in supporting these countries in the services that you described, the misinformation and disinformation machine, that is what it was seen to be, and as well as the security services, because they were called in some of these countries to sort of protect civilians against militia groups. Were they effective in doing that, and are they effective today in doing that?
It's hard to tell about the effectiveness of the African Corps yet, because it has been active for a year only now at this moment. So they are trying to present themselves as a very effective organization. Like, look, we come and any place where we come, we destroy all those Islamist insurgents or all that armed opposition or militia. We keep the locals safe and we keep the political situation stable. Was it true about, like, let's say, Central African Republic, which used to be one of the battlegrounds for Prigozhin's Wagner private military company? Well, in a way it was, yeah, because like Tuadera, who basically hired them, is still in power and is still like doing relatively well. Russia loves that projection of its power and loves to be seen as like a peacemaker or a peacekeeper in those hostile regions. But in fact, first, Russian Africa Corps operation is now relatively small, so they're not like too many fighters there, and for a good reason, obviously, because Russia needs those fighters to be fighting on the Ukraine front line, and especially now with the Ukraine's incursion in Kursk Oblast in Russia, it's in desperate need of manpower. I wouldn't predict that Russia would send massive troops to Africa now, considering its own situation at home.
Let's just close by talking about this figure, Prigozhin. How much of influence was he in Africa? Did he pull a lot of influence in the countries where Wagner operated?
He definitely had some influence. He probably had less of it than he described it himself and described it in his own media resources. But the fact that Russian Deputy Minister of Defense Yunus Bekiev-Kurov, accompanied by other Russian military officials, traveled through all those African countries where Wagner was active or allegedly active, and giving promises to the leaders, saying that all those agreements they used to have with Prigozhin will stay and will be fulfilled by the Russian government, and things will be like business as usual. It seems that Prigozhin has been able to gain some sort of influence and some sort of power in the African continent. It definitely poses a problem for Western powers, which would not benefit from any sort of instability in the region. And Russia mercenaries' presence in African countries creates that instability.
Thank you. We'll leave it there for today.
Good talking to you.
Sergei Goryashko from the BBC Russian Service. Let's now go to Burundi and talk about Mpox. For a second time in the last 2 years, the virus has been declared a global public health emergency by the World Health Organization. The current strain has driven an outbreak which has already killed 550 people in the Democratic Republic of Congo since the beginning of the year. The illness, previously known as monkeypox, has also been detected in Kenya, Rwanda, Uganda, and South Africa. In Burundi, over 170 cases have been recorded. Our correspondent, Mercy Juma, is there and joined me earlier.
So I am in Bujumbura and I've been here for, I would say, the last 48 hours now. First of all, when you get into the country, you know, just the journey on the plane, at the airport, driving through the streets and walking even in the streets of Bujumbura, you don't really get a sense of a country that is in the middle of really battling Mpox.
because I came in expecting that there will be measures around hand sanitizing, keeping a bit of a distance. Masking, especially indoor places, like has been proposed by some people, but that is entirely not happening. But upon visiting, you know, one of the isolation facilities, the treatment centers here in Bujumbura, and then you just see the gravity of the issue, because in one of the hospitals, the King Khalid University Hospital in Bujumbura, there's an isolation center with a bed capacity of 61, and 59 of the beds are filled with mpox patients with sores on their bodies, the blisters, you know, running fevers and all that, and this heightened sense of just cleanliness and keeping distance. And even getting in there, we had to put on like a lot of body protection gear, masks, you know, sanitize our shoes, our equipment and all that. The mood outside is, you know, nothing is happening. But when you get to the core of it, like the isolation facilities, you see the gravity of the issue. Majority of the people either just don't know there's mpox, or they don't even know what mpox is. One of the people that I spoke to in the isolation facility is a 40-year-old man who has been in hospital for the last 9 days, and he's still getting treatment for the sores and the blisters on his body. And he just explained to me what he was going through. And here is Ejid Irambona.
I had a friend who had blisters. I think I got it from him. I had swollen lymph nodes. It was so painful, I couldn't sleep. Then the pain subsided up here, and it moved to my legs. But I am better now.
Okay, that's Ejid Irambona. Now, Mercy, how are the local authorities responding to this outbreak there?
The immediate response right now is just to try and really sensitize people about what is going on, what mpox is, trying to ask people to do a lot of hand washing, which is a bit of a challenge, especially in Burundi, where resources like water are in many places hard to come by. And then they are also trying to really respond in terms of testing. But this is also a challenge because Burundi has only one testing laboratory that is serving the whole country. It takes a really long time for the health officials to go out or sample and test. And other than that, there is really no vaccination. Like, you know, Burundi has no vaccination, but also the testing kits are so limited. So there is a challenge of, you know, getting civic education out there and telling people this is what is happening, because there are so many challenges here. And even just speaking to people, you know, like contacting mpox is probably the least of their concern when it comes to what their priorities are, because they have to go out, get food for their families and all that. So everybody is just out there really trying to make life bearable for their families. So when you tell them to, you know, start keeping distance, watch out for certain symptoms and keep out from certain people, it's really at the back of their minds. And that is one of the big battles that the health officials here are fighting.
So, Mercy, you're describing quite, you know, a situation in Burundi where authorities on one side are fully aware of what's going on. They are doing what they can. The people have to do what they have to do to survive and get by, go on with their livelihoods. But if you look across the border in the DRC, the outbreak has been quite more severe than it is in Burundi. What measures are being taken to prevent a situation like that from happening in a country like Burundi, which is much, much smaller?
I would say that probably if things remain as they are, Charles, it's only a matter of time, unfortunately, before we see a replica probably of what is happening in DRC here in Burundi. Because as at this moment, the country is running out of testing kits, first of all. So in the next few days, Burundi will not be able to test for mpox. That is one challenge. So Burundi cannot really fight this war or fight mpox without the resources it needs. And one of its biggest appeal from the Ministry of Health is that it needs money. They are talking about a deficit of about $14 million that they need either from donors, from well-wishers, you know, from the international community. So we cannot even really start talking about how Burundi will fight this before we start talking about the resources or addressing the resources that are lacking for it to tackle the spread of mpox. And another fact is that Burundi shares a border with DRC, and it's almost an open border. People come in and go out. It's only about 25 minutes drive from Bujumbura to the nearest border town between DRC and Burundi. And that is a ticking time bomb, because people are coming in and they're coming in from a country that is really struggling with containing mpox. So in the next few days or few weeks, if a lot of effort, even from the international community, from the region, doesn't go into try to contain the spread through the borders, like the border between Burundi and Tanzania, Burundi and DRC and neighbors of DRC, we're going to see a replica, unfortunately, of what is happening in DRC around some of the countries in the region.
You said that the risk for regional spread is there, and governments across the Eastern and Southern African region have been really on high alert to make sure that it's not spreading as much as it could. But are there steps being taken to sort of contain this sort of spread, regionally speaking?
I would say regionally speaking, no, we haven't seen that strong voice coming up with a regional advocacy or regional measure to just try and contain the spread of mpox. What we are seeing is a lot of statements and a lot of concern that are within countries' borders, you know, like the Ministry of Health in Burundi, the Ministry of Health in Kenya, Tanzania, whatever, all those countries are trying to manage the spread within their own countries. There have been calls to just ensure a lot of surveillance around the borders, but we have not seen this. And like I said, you know, even when coming into such countries like Burundi, you would expect that there is, you know, like screening of people who are coming in, taking of temperatures, because we know fevers are some of the indicators of mpox, and just ensuring that there is no contact tracing in case somebody presents symptoms. But we haven't seen that. People are coming into these countries as they wish and living as they wish. So there has been no strong push from the region to try and contain this within the borders. This is also because probably there have been no like strong guidelines like when we had during COVID in terms of social distancing, masking up and all that, and restrictions that have come up. But if the spread continues at the rate that we are seeing, especially in countries like DRC, then we should expect that the region and the regional blocs will now start coming up with measures. Even we'll start seeing international guidelines on how to address people who are coming into specific countries, and just to enable or initiate contact tracing, which I think is very important yet lacking, especially in the context of the regional bloc here in Africa and Eastern Africa in particular.
Mercy Juma, BBC correspondent in Burundi. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
A $6 billion con.
It didn't take long for it to spread like wildfire.
You got to take a look at this really crazy gold stock. A buddy of mine got in at a dime.
Which destroyed lives and devastated communities.
Every little town across the nation, people have shares in this.
We lost everything.
And to date, no one has been brought to justice.
Somebody knows more than we know.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. All episodes are available now. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Funerals are a somber time for some. For others, it's a celebration of life. Whichever it is, they can be a costly affair. In fact, South Africa is said to be the fourth most expensive place to die in. That's according to a UK survey that looked at the average cost per funeral in 35 different countries around the world. The survey found that it cost about $1,500 for a funeral in South Africa. And according to reports in the Christian Science Monitor, an average funeral in Kenya can cost nearly $800. That's a huge amount in a country where the minimum wage is about $120 per month. This has prompted people to find ways to save up money for when they die. I've been speaking to John Otolo, who runs a savings scheme for last expenses in Kenya.
There are people who do not plan for funerals. They wait for unforeseen circumstances whereby it comes as an emergency, and then they have to look for money to do it. Another thing is that we have different cultural backgrounds. What we need to do is to accept that death is there, and we need to find a way on how we can reduce the burden, because at the end of the day, there are expenses that are involved.
I know it varies from culture to culture. So what are the main things that people will spend on when somebody dies?
People will spend on coffin. People will have to preserve the body. They will take the body to the morgue.
They'll have to get clothing for the body. There's also some other culture that they have to prepare meals.
It's like a ceremony. They'll have to ensure that they have a convoy of vehicles. Some of them will have to get T-shirts or they get nice eulogies for the family. They have to advertise in the newspaper, the TV and all that. So it depends with the financial muscles of a family and the person who has died. Those are the things that make funerals expensive.
So, John, then tell me about this organization that you founded. What is the main goal of this organization? Who is it meant for and how do you reach them?
When we were starting, we were looking for people with low income. Our vision was to facilitate and assist financially challenged Kenyans. But later we saw that we were not only reaching out to less fortunate people. So now we changed our vision to facilitate and assist Kenyans to get empowered in the event of unforeseen eventuality. People join because they want to get a decent send-off.
That's John Otolo. Despite the high costs, only 3% of Kenyans have a funeral insurance cover, according to a study by a French market research firm, Ipsos. Traditionally, the cost of burying a loved one was a shared activity, but due to the high cost of living, that responsibility has gradually shifted to bereaved families. Paul Ogola is someone who's had to pay for a funeral plan.
So how did you arrive at this, at deciding that you would be paying or setting some money aside for the last expenses?
This was prompted by an experience. I lost my father in 2016, and I had to go through a lot in order to accord my father a decent send-off.
Help us understand a bit more of the personal circumstances. I know it can be difficult to discuss, of how exactly you went about taking care of the expenses when your parent passed on.
Well, it was devastating being the only person in the family who had an income at that time. So the expenses were done, and I had to carry 80% of the burial expenses. I had to run into debts. Some I even paid up to 8 months after the burial. I had to do WhatsApp groups, had to talk to the church and friends to help me collect some funds and accord my father a decent send-off. And it was not easy for me. And this is why when I came across an organization that can do that for me, I openly joined.
So this scheme that you are now part of, how yes. does it work? How do contributions work and what happens when the time comes for that fund to be, you know, activated?
When I joined, I used to pay $5 per month in order to cover myself, my spouse, my 2 children who are below 18 years, my late mother now, and my mother-in-law. Until 2018, that is 2 years later after joining, when I lost my mother, then the organization came through for me by providing transportation, by providing an executive casket, mortuary expenses for 2 weeks, clothing, that is the dress, a lowering device, gazebo tent, and a trolley. And these are the most needed services in any funeral. I was able now to accord my mother a decent send-off without stress.
Right. You've described what you said is the most important expenses. But also we do know that there are other expenses, depending on the culture that you're talking about. It's almost like a celebration in terms of food and everything that goes with that. And those are some of the other expenses also that stretch the budget. So how then are you still able to take care of such expenses? And I'm not referring to your specific family case. I'm just getting your general thoughts, because those are the things that get people gathered around the table to contribute money, because we want to have a feast and other things alongside with the expenses that you described.
It is true that, yes, we also have got other financial needs in a burial. And even the organization that assisted me has the cash benefit part of it as well. I also received cash that helped me to sort out the other part of the feeding.
Right, I see. So let me ask you then, how does this kind of plan reflect your wishes for how you wish to be buried once you die?
I'm okay with it, irrespective of the culture, because some people find it difficult to speak about death, but it is inevitable. It strikes any time, any day, irrespective of the state, culture, race, and therefore I don't shy away from saying that when it comes, eventually someone has to be laid to rest.
I was speaking there to Paul Ogola. And that's Focus on Africa today. It was produced by Nur Abida, Marco Oriunto, Bella Hassan, Yvette Togira Maria, and Sunita Naha in London. Susan Gashohe and Frenny Joey did their bits here in Nairobi. Paul Bachibinga was in charge, and Jonathan Greer was our technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. Goodbye for now.
A $6 billion con.
It didn't take long for it to spread like wildfire.
You got to take a look at this really crazy gold stock. A buddy of mine got in at a dime.
Which destroyed lives and devastated communities.
Every little town across the nation, people have shares in this.
We lost everything.
And to date, no one has been brought to justice.
Somebody knows more than we know.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. All episodes are available now. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.